This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Ira Flatow is away. We've all been there, right? A crowded bar or restaurant. You're straining to hear what your friend is saying. Even without thinking about it, you probably start to look back and forth, from the eyes to the mouth, from the mouth to the eyes, trying to lip read a little bit, trying to get a few more clues about each word. Well, it turns out we learn that skill pretty young. Even infants do it. But babies growing up in bilingual households tend to focus a little more on the mouth than other babies. My next guest says that might be a vital clue to the best way for people of all ages to learn a second language, maybe the best way to raise a language-learning child, too. David Lefkowitz is a professor in the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders at Northeastern University in Boston. He joins us from WGBH today. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Lefkowitz.
Thank you very much, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
And if you've caught your baby lip reading, you can give us a call, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SciTalk. You can also tweet us at SciFry. So, David, a few years ago, you discovered that babies do focus on the mouths of people who are speaking. What is new in this current study?
Well, in that previous study, what we studied were actually monolingual English learning babies. And there we found that by the time babies begin to babble around 8 and 10 months of age, they actually shift their attention to the mouth of their interlocutor during social interaction. So in this new study, what we did is we asked whether bilingual babies who are learning at two different languages might actually take advantage even more of the information that is located in the lips, and therefore would they lip read more? And it turns out that they do indeed do so.
What made you think to ask that question?
Well, actually, I have a couple of colleagues with whom I did this study in Barcelona in Spain, Ferran Pons and Laura Bosch. These are folks who have been studying the development of language for quite some time. And when we initially published our first findings with the monolingual English learning babies, we began to discuss these findings, and my colleagues who have access to bilingual babies in Spain, those babies are learning Spanish as well as Catalan, said, hey, this is the next obvious study to do. Let's go and have a look at what bilingual babies do. And lo and behold, indeed, we found that they lip read even more.
So how do we know that studying the lips actually helps babies with comprehension? I mean, maybe looking at a mouth is just more interesting than looking at the eyes. The mouth's doing something. How do we know that it helps them learn?
Right. That's a great point, actually. And it turns out that we have data that speak to that very point from other studies where we have studied babies at various ages. So the youngest age that we've studied is 4 months of age. And those babies we know are very much interested in things that move. There are many studies that indicate that. It turns out that babies at 4 months of age, when they watch people talking, actually do not look at the mouth, but rather look at the eyes. So this is despite the fact that there is all that motion going on, it doesn't capture their attention as it does babies just 4 months later. So that sort of evidence indicates to us that indeed what babies really are doing when they begin to focus on the mouth region is that they are now tuning in to the audiovisual speech signal per se, and that they're processing this information as speech and language.
So in couples where the parents have different mother tongues, sometimes one parent sticks to one language, the other parent the other language. What's the rationale for doing that?
Right. Well, you see, that's so interesting, actually. It turns out that this one-person, one-language approach to teaching babies two different languages in bilingual homes, it turns out there's not a lot of evidence to support the utility of that. In other words, babies would not be confused if one parent speaks both languages as opposed to one. And I should say also that there's not a great deal of evidence yet on the development of two different languages in bilingual infants. This is an area that is just now beginning to receive a great deal of attention. So there there's a lot of information we still do not have, but at least this one person, one language approach does not seem to make a great deal of sense.
I want to go to a phone call here. Owen is calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Owen.
Hey, how you doing?
Oh, good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
So I was just listening to you guys, and my daughter is 4 months old. Well, 5 months old, I'm sorry. And when she was 4 months, she was so intense, just looking into my eyes. And I speak Creole to her because I'm Haitian. And my wife is, you know, full-blown American, as sweet potato pie. And when I start speaking to her now, she's intense on my mouth. And it's as if she's trying to shape the words in Creole that I'm speaking to her with her mouth. Like, I can see that her mouth is trying to form the words that I'm saying as she stares at my mouth. And I found that, like, really interesting.
Oh, and thank you so much for the phone call. So there you go, David.
Well, that particular observation fits precisely the data that we obtain, in that, if I understood correctly, his daughter is now about 5 months of age. And what we found, in fact, with our bilingual babies in Spain was that even at 4 months, whereas babies who are learning a single language tend to focus on the eyes, our bilingual babies now are no longer doing that. In fact, they're sort of going back and forth between the eyes and the mouth. So what he was suggesting, in fact, his daughter is doing is precisely the kind of thing that we found in our study, that his daughter was, in fact, already beginning to show an interest in mouth motion related to speech.
So how can we apply this to adult language learning? I mean, we've always heard that kids have an easier time picking up a second language than adults do. Could this tell us something about how adults might use lip reading to pick up a second language? Is there anything in it for us?
Right. Well, the answer is a bit complex, but in overall, I would say the answer would be yes. And the reason it's complex is because one of the things that we know from a great deal of research is that the younger that we are, the more plastic our nervous system is. And what that means is that our nervous system is much more open to experiences in our world and is much more able to encode those kinds of experiences, no matter what they are. And that as we grow and as we mature and as we receive information from our immediate native world, if you will, we start to narrow our capacity to deal with information that is unfamiliar to us, that we're not getting as often, you see. And this process of perceptual narrowing is what makes it more difficult for us as we get older to learn other languages, because we simply no longer have that same perceptual sensitivity to the sounds of other languages, to the way those sounds look on the lips when someone is speaking. So in general, it's harder for us adults to learn other languages, but nonetheless, we can still do it. And to answer your final question about whether or not lip reading might help, it can, it should. And the reason for that is because there is a good deal of evidence also from adult studies indicating that when adults are presented with speech, for example, in noise or ambiguous kinds of speech that is hard to understand, if you allow the adults to read the lips at the same time, to see it, the articulations, they do better in comprehension.
So you're suggesting that if we're trying to learn a second language by driving around in the car with one of those tapes, it's not going to be as useful as maybe immersing yourself and actually seeing someone say the language as well.
Precisely. And besides, if you're driving around trying to learn a second language, good luck. you'd be rather distracted, right? So, yes, of course. I think that the most effective way to learn a second language is to be actually interacting socially, probably, with another speaker. That's probably the best way to learn a second language.
Why do we get away from lip reading as adults? Why aren't we always staring at someone's mouth as they're talking?
Wonderful question. Well, it turns out that, you know, we humans are very social species, right? And it turns out that our eyes are, if you will, a window into our minds and souls. Our eyes are really the source of a great deal of social information, a great deal of information about our intentions and so forth. So we as adults really rely on other people's eyes to kind of inform us about what the other person is thinking, if you will. And we're constantly trying to guess what each other is thinking and intending to do. And that's why we focus on the eyes. But nonetheless, you know, as you said in your introductory piece, as soon as we find ourselves in a challenging speech situation, such as a bar, you know, a loud bar, a loud restaurant, it turns out that we go back to those kinds of skills that we developed as babies and begin to lip read just to help our comprehension.
We just have a minute left, but getting back to raising kids, it takes us back to something that I think has changed about parenting. A lot of parents these days are probably looking at their smartphone while they're telling their kids to do something, not really engaging, not looking straight ahead when talking. It seems like the things that you're studying suggest you might want to have a little bit more face time with your kids.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. I think, you know, those of us who study development know this as a sort of a fact that the best way to raise children and the best way to encourage their development is to interact with them in the most appropriate social way possible. And that's really how we evolved as a species, to really be interacting with one another en face, if you will. And so I would definitely encourage parents to try to maximize those kinds of situations where they're providing their infants with combined auditory and visual information, and indeed other kinds of stimulation. Tactile is also very important. You know, when we interact with our babies, we should be touching them, we should be holding them, and of course babies also happen to respond to our smells and so on.
David Lefkowitz, a professor in the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders at Northeastern University in Boston, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up next, the movie Still Alice has millions of us thinking about Alzheimer's and this question, why are so many more women than men diagnosed with the disease? That's coming up next. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Ira Flatow's away. The Oscars are this Sunday, and one of the nominees is Julianne Moore. She's up for Best Actress for her role in the film Still Alice. In the movie, she plays a Columbia University professor grappling with early-onset Alzheimer's. Here she describes what it's like to live with the disease.
It's not always the same. You know, I have good days, bad days, and on my good days, I can, you know, almost pass for a normal person. But on my bad days, I feel like I can't find myself.
While her diagnosis in the film is rare, in one way she represents the typical Alzheimer's patient. She's a woman. According to the Alzheimer's Association, 1 in 6 women over the age of 65 are at risk for developing Alzheimer's. Men in the same age range have a 1 in 11 chance of developing the disease. Currently, 2/3 of Americans with Alzheimer's are women. Why do so many more women have Alzheimer's than men? Can it all be chalked up to a longer life expectancy? To parse out some of this recent research on why women may be more likely to have the disease, I'm joined by Michael Gracious. He's medical director of the Stanford Center for Memory Disorders at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. Michael, welcome to our program.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Also, Roberta Diaz-Brinton is here. She's professor of pharmacology and neurology and the R. Pete Vanderveen Chair in Therapeutic Discovery and Development at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
If you've got questions, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. You can always tweet us at SciFry. So, Dr. Brinton, let's get to that first question first. Any truth to the idea that more women have Alzheimer's simply because they live longer than men?
It is true that women live on average around 4 to 5 years longer than men, but that probably doesn't explain the fact that women constitute 2/3 of all persons with Alzheimer's disease. It is more likely the way that they age that puts them at risk, not the 4 years longer that they live.
When you say the way that they age, tell us more.
Women undergo a transition in their life called the menopause and the perimenopause, which precedes it. It's a bit like a transition like the puberty. We all go through puberty and we go in one way and we come out another. And 90% of us go into puberty and come out and we're just fine. And then there's the 10% of people who develop in males, typically it's schizophrenia, and in females, it can be depression. And the perimenopause is another transition for the brain that women experience uniquely. And that transition, our work has shown that that transition is actually a neurological transition. It's a transition in the ability of the brain to generate sufficient energy to keep all those systems working well.
So you're saying women's brains really age differently than men's brains because of this phenomenon?
Yes, they do. And most women will transition through the perimenopause and the menopause quite well. And then there will be a proportion of women who will begin to experience neurological symptoms that are seemingly unrelated to the kind of reproductive change that's happening. And those neurological symptoms can manifest themselves as decline in cognitive function, particularly short-term memory function. It can manifest by insomnia, by depression, or changes in affect. And those kinds of symptoms, neurological symptoms, we know begin to be a risk factor for developing Alzheimer's disease, particularly if there are more than one of them and that they don't resolve with the cessation of the reproductive years and menopause.
So in part, you're looking at whether or not there's a connection between a lack of estrogen during and after menopause and development of Alzheimer's.
Yes, a lack of estrogen because estrogen, I call it the queen of Darwin. Estrogen has left nothing to chance in the female brain. And part of what estrogen does is regulate the ability, it promotes the ability of the brain to generate energy, literally from the taking up of glucose into the brain to converting that glucose into ATP or energy. So when there is a decline in estrogen, there's also a change in the brain that now manifests itself again as a decline in its ability to utilize glucose as its primary fuel, which it's supposed to be. And now there's a switch. There's a switch to an alternative fuel. Again, it's not all or nothing. It's about 20% switch from a highly efficient fuel, glucose, to an alternative fuel, ketone bodies. It looks like the brain is becoming a little diabetic. It looks like the brain is starving.
Every woman goes through menopause. Not every woman develops Alzheimer's, obviously. Why might certain women develop the disease versus others?
There are a couple of potential reasons. One is if they've had a mother with Alzheimer's disease. Our mitochondrial DNA, so there are two repositories of DNA in the cell. There's the one that we all know about is in the nucleus, and then there's another bit of DNA in the mitochondria, and we receive that mitochondria only from our mother. So if our mother had Alzheimer's disease, we are at greater risk because that mitochondrial DNA is only inherited from the mother. So that is actually a risk factor for both women and men. And the other is that there is likely kind of genetic differences in the nuclear DNA that encodes and is regulated by estrogen that encodes all the pieces for this energetic system in the brain.
We're talking with Roberta Diaz-Brinton, who studies estrogen and Alzheimer's disease. And I want to turn next to Michael Gracious about some of your work. And if you have questions, by the way, 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK as we talk about women and Alzheimer's. Dr. Gracious, you looked at a gene associated with Alzheimer's that both women and men have. What gene is this?
Right, so the gene's called APOE, and it comes in three different sort of flavors or variants, APOE2, APOE3, and APOE4. And most people have two copies of the APOE3 gene, but it's the APOE4 gene that confers this increased risk for Alzheimer's disease.
So under what circumstances does this gene have a different impact on women than men?
Right. So this has been a question. It's actually been in the literature since about 1997. There was a really large meta-analysis of genetic studies. It was published in JAMA, which is among our most reputable journals. And for some reason, it kind of got buried. But the finding was that women that carried one copy of this risk gene, this APOE4 gene, bumped up their risk of developing Alzheimer's about fourfold. And men in this study with one copy of the APOE4 gene really didn't bump their risk up at all compared to men with the neutral gene. So there was this big interaction between APOE4 and sex that was shown in 1997 and then, with some rare exceptions, kind of eclipsed or lost to the literature for unclear reasons.
So what could account for this? I mean, what do you think this might be?
Well, you know, at first I wasn't convinced that this was actually the case. I mean, like I said, it was sort of mysterious that it hadn't been picked up on. I happened on this paper about 10 or 12 years after it came out. I'd already been seeing patients for, 10 or 12 years and never thought about a sex-based difference in APOE4 risk. So to convince ourselves of this, we've done a few studies examining this interaction between APOE4 and sex. And I think the most compelling one that we've done thus far is to follow healthy older controls, so people without any memory trouble. This is a big publicly available database that we were able to explore. There are about 5,000 subjects that were followed for about 4 years, and we could separate them by sex and also by their APOE4 status. And there we found that men with just one copy of the APOE4 gene, again, really don't have an increased risk for conversion to mild cognitive impairment or to Alzheimer's disease compared to men without the APOE4 gene. But in women, even with one copy, their risk for converting from healthy aging to a memory impairment state was about 1.8-fold, almost 2-fold increased risk. So this sort of convinced us that this is a real finding, obviously some important biology behind this that we need to explore further. Certainly related to estrogen, it turns out that this APOE gene, this risk gene for Alzheimer's, has what's called an estrogen response element on the sort of front end of it. And so that we think estrogen controls at some level the expression of this gene. And Dr. Brinton's group has done some nice work in this particular domain. So it may be that at menopause, as estrogen levels decline, there are changes in the expression of this APOE4 gene.
Dr. Brinton, could you pick up on that a little bit?
Well, thank you, Michael and John. So that the APOE is a protein that transports cholesterol in the brain. It also transports beta amyloid. And it's not a particularly good transporter. Probably the best transporter is APOE2, and APOE3 is pretty good. But APOE4 kind of doesn't do a very good job. And now all of a sudden, we have a decline in the ability to transport cholesterol, and the brain has to make its own cholesterol. It doesn't transport it from the periphery. So here we have the transporter, if you will, almost like the slowdown in the LA ports. It's a good analogy because that's essentially an APOE4 effect. It works, but it's kind of slow and sluggish. Now what we have is kind of this buildup of cholesterol. We're not able to renew that source, and we're not able to make the steroids in the brain because cholesterol has to be transported across the plasma membrane into the mitochondria, where cholesterol then is the mother of all steroids. So now if you remove those steroids from the ovary, the brain is actually kind of very steroid depleted and has a deficiency. That's one hypothesis. The other is that it's not clearing beta amyloid very well. And again, estrogen regulates several of the proteins in the brain that clear beta amyloid out of the brain. Again, so it's almost like the 1-2 hit where you can go through the perimenopause and the menopause and everything's fine. But now you have this increased kind of burden of dysfunction. And that oftentimes is the tipping point.
Hmm. Let's get to some questions from listeners. Julia is calling from San Francisco. Hello, Julia. You're on Science Friday.
Hi. How are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
My question is, if a woman's hormonal changes put her at risk, does the fact that she's had children or not had children have any impact on her risk factors?
It's a great question. Dr. Brinton?
So there is some interesting literature on that. And there was a recent study that came out that showed that women who breastfed their infants actually had a reduced risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. There are other studies that show that, you know, women with many pregnancies are at greater risk. The real issue, I think the field has not yet completely understood the role of pregnancy. I will tell you, though, that pregnancy turns out to be a good thing for the moms. We're developing a therapeutic for early stage Alzheimer's disease that's a regenerative therapeutic based on this molecule that's made by both men and women, but made in great abundance by pregnant women. It's allopregnanolone, and it promotes the regeneration of the brain, the generation of new neurons, and the reduction in Alzheimer's pathology. So it's a fertile field.
I'm John Dankosky. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Luann has a question. She's also calling from San Francisco. Hi, Luann. What's your question?
Hi, how are you? Love the show, and I love both of your guests. I just was wondering, in terms of a strategy for women postmenopause, who are obviously at greatest risk, if they have the APOE4 gene, wouldn't it be reasonable to consider placing her on a supervised estrogen replacement therapy as a preventative for Alzheimer's?
Thank you very much for the question, because it's something we wanted to get to. Michael Gracious, I'll ask you that first about hormone therapy as we start to talk more about estrogen and the possibilities here.
Yeah, so this is a very controversial and complex area, and if you followed the literature in the lay press, you know that hormone replacement therapy, the recommendations on that have sort of gone back and forth over the last decade or so. I think Luann's question is actually right on the money, and it's one that hasn't been explored closely enough. So most of the big hormone replacement studies, in particular the Women's Health Initiative and the memory version of that called WIMS, or the Women's Health Initiative Memory Study, looked at hormone replacement and asked whether this would stave off dementia. In fact, in the WIMS study, there was an increased risk of dementia in women that were on estrogen and progesterone compared to placebo. So our current recommendation is that we don't recommend hormone replacement therapy for memory loss or cognitive trouble. But back to Luann's question, it really hasn't been looked at closely. It could well be that E4 carriers may be more likely to benefit from estrogen replacement therapy. The other big controversial issue there is that the WIMS study looked at estrogen and hormone replacement therapy after age 65. The mean age of menopause is around 50 or 51, and there's a reasonable hypothesis that maybe we're kind of missing the window by starting it later, and so people are now studying the effects of earlier replacement. But that issue of does hormone replacement therapy work differently, better or worse, in E4 carriers or non-carriers is a big one and needs to get asked and answered.
Dr. Brinton, a quick thought on this?
A quick thought is that that is our next big area of investigation, and we're very excited to get started. We've already started conducting analyses with colleague Dr. Lisa Mosconi at NYU, examining the effects of this genotype on glucose metabolism in the brain and the development of beta amyloid. So we are definitely on it, and we are racing forward.
Just very, very quickly, do you think there's a need to do more studies of women and men differently when it comes to Alzheimer's research?
Absolutely. I think that's a great point, John, that men and women do age differently. And interestingly, when you look at the risk for developing Alzheimer's disease, men have a bit of an increased risk early, around age 65 or so, and more than women, but then women take over the risk in their 70s.
Roberta Diaz-Brinton is a professor of pharmacology and neurology and R. Pete Van Deveen Chair in Therapeutic Discovery and Development at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, John.
Thanks also to Michael Gracious, who's medical director of the Stanford Center for Memory Disorders at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me, John. Thanks for taking on the topic.
Coming up after the break, we'll take on another topic. We'll look at the future of web and mobile mapping. 10 years now since Google Maps started. We'll find out what the future looks like. Coming up next. This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Ira Flatow is away. Believe it or not, this month marks the 10-year anniversary of Google Maps. Do you remember what you did before Google Maps? Did you rely on printouts from MapQuest? Anyone remember Microsoft's Encarta? Personally, I used to drive around with a dog-eared copy of an atlas I bought at the grocery store. Today, web and mobile maps are everywhere, and we use them for more than just getting from point A to point B. So what will maps look like in the next decade? Will they be able to get us around more efficiently? Where would you like to see mobile maps headed in our future? You can call us at 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry. My next guest was able to get a tour inside Google's latest mapping project, Project Ground Truth. Craig Miller is co-founder of Wired's Map Lab blog, a freelance science journalist based out of San Francisco. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell us about this Ground Truth project. What exactly is Google trying to do here?
Yeah, this is really interesting. This is a project that started in 2008 and was kind of kept under wraps for a while, but the overall goal is to keep Google's maps as up-to-date and accurate as possible. And, you know, if you take time to think about it, that's no easy thing to do. The world is a changing place. New roads are being built, and housing developments pop up. Shopping malls get torn down. So there's a lot of change to keep the maps accurate and up to date. And the way Google's doing it, I think, is really interesting. It's kind of a combination of artificial intelligence and old-fashioned human labor. And the artificial intelligence side of it is comes into play with all of the imagery that Google uses that go into their maps. They have satellite data, aerial data, and the street view data. And they're using computer vision algorithms to pour over those images and extract features that are really important for people who are trying to use Google Maps app to get around. So things like lane restrictions, the markers on the lanes on the highway that tell you which turns you're allowed to make from a given lane, addresses, all kinds of things like that, street signs, because the data they get from official government sources doesn't always necessarily line up with what you see in front of you when you're driving around. So part of what the algorithms are doing are trying to extract the actual words that are on the signs and the actual addresses that are on the buildings so that when the Google lady tells you turn left on this road, the name that she says is actually the name that you see in front of you.
So it's not just computers doing all this, though. They've got lots of people massaging this data that they're collecting.
Yeah, that's right. So the algorithms are good and they're getting better, but they only get you so far. There's still things that the human brain is a lot better at. And so Google has a small army of people. They wouldn't tell me exactly how many, but my sense is that it's lots who are going over the maps and checking up on the algorithms to make sure that where the road gets placed is actually where the road is on the satellite image. And also people who use Google Maps, if you, I don't know if most people know this, but if you sort of shake the phone while you're in the app, it'll pull up a dialogue box that lets you report a problem, like an address that's wrong or a road that isn't where it should be. And they get and review tens of thousands of those error reports every day from users. So that kind of gives you an idea of the sort of manpower that must be involved to sustain that.
Now, Nokia, meanwhile, is building up their HERE map. Are they collecting their data in a different way than Google is?
Well, one of the things, so Nokia HERE is has a map that you can use for navigation. It's actually built into a lot of cars already. It's not always branded as Nokia. It just looks like BMW or Audi or whatever the car maker might be. But one of the things that they're interested in, actually Google is interested in this too, is autonomous cars, looking forward to a future in which our cars do more of the driving for us.
And that really seems like the end result of all of this, with all these different companies trying to make their own maps and collecting all of this data far beyond what we used to have. It just seemed like that's where we're headed, right, Greg? That they're going to try to sell us driverless cars that can go wherever we tell them to go.
Yeah, it's a little exciting or scary, depending on your perspective. But yeah, that does seem to be the way that things are going. Our cars are already getting more and more autonomous. But if we're ever going to get to a world where we can get into our car and make a sandwich during our commute to work, we're going to need maps that are a lot higher definition, even than the best maps we have today for turn-by-turn directions. And so that does require a whole new kind of mapping effort. So, for instance, Nokia, I was fortunate to visit them and get a tour in one of the cars that they're using to create their version of this high-definition map. And it was just a regular old Volkswagen Jetta, but it had a big contraption on top with all kinds of instruments. It had GPS and it had LiDAR, which is just kind of looks like a spinning soda can, but it shoots out lots of laser beams and measures the way the light reflects back. And from that, you can get centimeter resolution information about the surroundings, so things like the height of a curb that's really important if you're in an autonomous car, but maybe not so much if you're just using maps for turn-by-turn driving directions like we do now.
Yeah, that's a little bit too much information for me, but I can see why my driverless car might need to know how high the curb is.
You don't want to be on the sidewalk.
No, you don't. Greg Miller is co-founder of Wired's Map Lab blog. He's a freelance science journalist based out of San Francisco. He took us behind the scenes at the Google Ground Truth Project. Thanks so much, Greg. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
I'd like to bring on another guest who's been making web maps in the days long before Google Maps, before they were even on the map. Steve Coast is founder of OpenStreetMap. He's based out of Denver, Colorado. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell us how OpenStreetMap is different from Google Maps, first of all.
So OpenStreetMap focuses on the data behind the map. So, you know, as you as a consumer, you look at a map and it's coloring the freeways one thing and roads another and lakes another. There's a bunch of data behind that that we want to give the public access to. In the same way that you could go use Wikipedia and you can edit the text behind it and make a correction or add a paragraph. In OpenStreetMap, you can look at the map, you can hit edit. And if you see some sort of mistake or something missing or something you want to add, you can just go directly in there and we trust you, just like Wikipedia, to make that correction in the map itself. And then those corrections are aggregated. We have nearly 2 million people around the world with registered accounts on OpenStreetMap who are adding that data into the map, and we make it completely freely available to all of them.
How objectively accurate is OpenStreetMap compared to some of the other technologies that we see out there right now?
Well, the best way is just go and look at it yourself. It's extremely good. It misses a few types of classes of data, so things that are harder to collect, like addressing, for example. But if you were to compare and contrast, just have you know, some other map on the side and then look at OpenStreetMap, I think you'll be surprised. It'd be like asking you know, how complete is Wikipedia? It's exceptionally complete in its sort of breadth and depth.
Now, you created OpenStreetMap back in 2004, before Google Maps was around. What was it like trying to develop web maps during this, you know, early period in this technology?
It was pretty basic. You know, access to GPS was a lot harder. The iPhone hadn't been invented. Smartphones weren't around. The availability of satellite imagery was pretty poor. You know, most of the maps at the time, if you wanted to go north or zoom out, you had to click a button and the page would reload. We didn't have so-called slippy maps that you could just drag around. So it was pretty clunky and it was pretty basic a decade ago.
As we take a look back at 10 years of Google Maps, we're going to take some of your ideas about the future of mapping and technology. 844-724-8255. Let's go to Jordan, who's calling from Folsom, California. Hi there, Jordan. You're on Science Friday.
Yes, hi. I'm often frustrated by driving around and looking for parking spots, and I was wondering if there's any possibility of getting sort of a live view on a map of where parking spots might be available.
Wow, so that's a really good idea. That makes a lot of sense, right? That's exactly the sort of thing you need to know while you're driving around a city. I'm wondering, Steve Coast, how possible is something like that?
There's a number of apps for different phones. One of them that I use is called ParkNav, as an example, that will show open parking spots nearby. The Scout, the app that Telenav produces, my employer, does the same thing. And Scout also uses OpenStreetMap, so you get a double bonus there.
You know, one of the things that your technology and other traffic systems like Waze kind of relies on is people typing in information, and sometimes on the fly. And I wonder if there's any worries about that, about people reporting back things like a parking space that's open or a policeman that might be by the side of the road while they're actually supposed to be doing, you know, driving at the same time.
That's definitely an issue. I think, you know, if I had to give you advice, I'd say keep your eyes on the road and don't use your phone. And that's why so many apps have warnings on them, and they don't even let you edit when it detects that the vehicle is moving.
Mm. Another quick phone call here from Isaac, who's calling from Camden, South Carolina. Hi, Isaac.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What's up?
Oh, thank you for having me on the show. Love Science Friday. Big fan. So I'm a GIS professional, and one of the things I'd love to see is more data-driven maps that are easily accessible to the general public. You know, you've got things like QGIS and OpenGIS available, but if those kind of data-driven things can be incorporated in a more user-friendly kind of way with, you know, like a Google map.
Mm. Thanks very much for the phone call. Steve, what do you say?
So, you know, allowing consumers access to those kinds of tools is definitely something that's going to, you know, help the world be a much better place, because when you democratize this technology, you get new ideas out of it, right? Now, QGIS is an open source GIS software that anyone can download, and you have to pair that software with data, which is why I founded OpenStreetMap in the first place, because it's one thing to have a tool to manipulate a map, but if you don't have any map data to manipulate in the first place, you're kind of out of luck there. You're seeing more and more GIS software appear on the web as well. Esri's spending a lot of time and money making that happen, and really bringing down the barrier to entry and making this part of also educational courses so that kids know how to use this stuff too.
Indoor mapping is something that companies are trying to get into now. How far have we progressed in that area?
We're getting pretty far. Indoor maps are getting better and better. The difficulty is always lack of GPS, and so you know, people are making the leap to using all types of different Bluetooth and other beacons so that your phone can figure out where it is. When we have good indoor maps, it means that all kinds of possibilities are going to open up again. When your phone knows not just that you're at the mall, but whereabouts you are at the mall, where your friends are, and so on, it's at that point when developers are going to be able to come up with new experiences that exploit that data. You know, so right now I might be able to just meet you at the mall, but getting real-time navigation as a pedestrian inside the mall to find exactly where you are is going to change things.
I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Something we were thinking about along those lines, though, is I can imagine a smart company getting a hold of this information, Steve, and saying, yes, here's a very good walking path for you. Just walk past this Starbucks and past this McDonald's, and you'll have a perfectly nice walk along the way. And is that part of the problem of mapping in the 21st century?
It's not a problem yet. I hope it will be, because you never know. It might actually be a nice walk, you know. Any tool has, you know, just like a brick, right? You've got great users for bricks. You can build houses. You've got bad users. You can throw them through windows, right? But it's really your choice what you do with that new technology.
You know, you were talking about how OpenStreetMap lets users modify the maps. What are some of the more interesting things that you've seen users do with this open source availability that you give them?
Well, I mean, so the most surprising thing to me was when I saw that Cuba was so well mapped. And, you know, Cuba's not a place that's well known for having access to the internet and technology, but people use it in places like that. There are areas of Germany where people are mapping every single tree in a neighborhood, including, you know, the type of tree it is and its age. I saw someone mapping base jumping spots. Pretty much anything you could possibly imagine is in the map. I mean, here in Colorado, we have great skiing maps as an example. And maps are very personal, right? So hikers tend to make great hiking maps in OSM. Cyclists are adding a lot of cycle data and so on. And it's the amalgamation of all of these things, including the base street map that we all use, and going above and beyond that into these new types of data that makes OpenStreetMap so powerful.
I want to get to a quick phone call. Deborah's in Marquette, Michigan. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, I'm a lifelong member of AAA, and one of the benefits of it belonging to them is getting as many maps as you want. And I've driven in my little Volkswagen Rabbit up from the Upper Peninsula to New York and back again into Florida, I've done a lot of driving, and I can't imagine not using a map because it's so much fun. And I think I have about 150. I've never literally counted, but.
And when you say using a map, you mean the actual maps you get from the AAA that you look at, or a piece of paper that you get printed out for you?
Yes, I have one of where I have one hanging right now on a clothing hanger that I like to look at. I mean, it's so much. It's great looking at maps.
Sorry, Deborah. I just want to quickly get a thought from Steve Coast on this. I mean, there is something, just like we talk about the future of books. You know, people love to feel the print in their hand. There is something about actually having a map, and maybe we're losing a little something about learning to read maps and the direction we're heading by just sort of mindlessly following all these navigation devices that we have.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Actually, I think anyone out there who's reliant on GPS as their sole way of getting around is, you know, probably spend some time with some real mapping and figure out how to go above and beyond the GPS. If for no other reason than the GPS will sometimes send you the wrong way.
So, Steve, a last thing for you quickly. Is mobile mapping constrained by our networks or anything else? I mean, what's keeping us from the next big breakthrough in the mapping world?
So network bandwidth is definitely a limiter for the amount of data you can send down the pipe to the phone, which limits, for example, 3D, which requires an awful lot of data to do anything meaningful. The big limitation, I think, is really engagement. The more people that were to engage with a project like OpenStreetMap means with the better data we get, which means the more people that we can engage in the first place. You know, then allowing people access to the technology is what we need to go for.
Well, I know the next thing I'm going to do after the show is I'm going to take a look at that map of Cuba, see where I might want to visit someday, I suppose. Well, Steve Coast, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for your time.
Steve Coast is founder of OpenStreetMap. One last note for our listeners here in New York City in the tri-state area. IRA will be hosting Science Friday's first ever live trivia event on Wednesday, May 13th. It's at the Bell House in Brooklyn. You can find out more and get your tickets at sciencefriday.com/trivia. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. If you missed any part of this program or you would like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts, both audio and video, or point your tablet or smartphone to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you can join our mailing list. If you like us on Facebook. You can continue a week-long discussion on Twitter at SciFry. And always send us a letter, Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, Room 412, New York, New York, 10036. And you can email us, SciFry@sciencefriday.com. Ira's back next week in New York. I'm John Dankosky.